This is Cody Boynes on Monday, April 6th for the Talking Information Center, reading today for the Monday Associated Press News. Airstrikes on Iran kill more than 25 as new ceasefire proposal is shared. Israel and the United States carried out a wave of attacks on Iran on Monday, killing more than 25 people, and Iran responded with missile fire on Israel and its Gulf Arab neighbors. U.S. President Donald Trump's deadline for Tehran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz loomed as mediators circulated a new ceasefire proposal. Explosions rang out in Tehran and low-flying jets could be heard for hours as the capital was pounded. Thick black smoke rose near the city's Azadi Square after one airstrike hit the grounds of the Sharif University of Technology. Among those killed in one of the attacks on Tehran was the head of the intelligence for Iran's paramilitary Revolutionary Guard, Major General Majid Kademi, according to Iranian state media and Israel's defense minister. Iranian missiles hit off the northern city of Haifa, where four people were found dead in the rubble of a residential building. Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia all activated their air defenses to intercept incoming Iranian missiles and drones as Tehran kept up the pressure on its Gulf neighbors. Iran's regular attacks on regional energy infrastructure and its stranglehold on the Strait of Hormuz, through which a fifth of the world's oil is shipped in peacetime, has sent global energy prices soaring. Under pressure at home as consumers are growing increasingly concerned, Trump gave Tehran a deadline that expires Monday night, Washington time, saying if no deal was reached to reopen the strait, the U.S. would hit Iran's power plants and other infrastructure targets and set the country back to the Stone Ages. Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped up in one in Iran, he threatened in a social media post, adding that if Iran did not open the strait, you'll be living in hell. In an effort to stop the fighting, Egyptian, Pakistani, and Turkish mediators have sent Iran and the U.S. a proposal calling for a 45-day ceasefire and the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz to give time to try to find a way to end the war, two Mideast officials have told the Associated Press. Iran and the U.S. have not responded to the proposal sent late Sunday night to both Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Arabachi and U.S. Mideast envoy Steve Witkoff, the official said. The official spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss the private negotiations. Trump's deadline to open Hormuz Strait looms, but no signs of Tehran backing off. European Council President Antonio Costa called for diplomacy to be given a chance, writing on X that any targeting of civilian infrastructure, namely energy facilities, is illegal and unacceptable. Escalation will not achieve a ceasefire in peace, he said. Only negotiations will, namely the ongoing efforts led by regional partners. Trump has at times demanded that Iran reopen the strait or face a significant escalation in bombing from the U.S., while at other times said it was not up to Washington to force the waterway open or even that the war could end without it being reopened. He has also given multiple deadlines to Iran on the issue, and after the threat he posted Sunday, he later posted a single line saying, Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. It was not clear whether that meant he had extended the deadline another day. Tehran has shown no signs of backing down from its stranglehold on shipping through the strait, which was fully open before Israel and the U.S. attacked Iran on February 28th to start the war. Following Trump's explicit laced post on Easter Sunday, Iran's parliamentary speaker, Mohammed Bagar Khalif, called the threats of targeting Iran's infrastructure reckless. You won't gain anything through war crimes, Khalif wrote on X. The only real solution is respecting the rights of the Iranian people and ending this dangerous game. Brent crude oil, the international standard, rose to $109 in early Monday spot trading, some 50% higher than it was when the war started. Iran has let some vessels through the strait since the war began, but none belonging to the U.S., Israel, or countries perceiving as helping them. Some have paid Iran for passage, and the overall flow of traffic is down more than 90% over the same period last year. Airstrikes kill more than 25 across Iran. One of Monday morning's airstrikes targeted Tehran's Sharif University of Technology, where Iranian media reported damage to the buildings as well as natural gas distribution site next to the campus. It wasn't immediately clear what had been targeted on the grounds of the university, which is empty of students as the war has forced all schools into the country into online classes. However, multiple countries over the years have sanctioned the university for its work with the military, particularly on Iran's ballistic missile program, which is controlled by the country's Parliamentary Revolutionary Guard. Following the confirmation that the Guard's intelligence chief had been killed in one strike, Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz vowed to keep targeting top-ranking Iranian officials. Iran's leaders live with a sense of being targeted, Katz said. We will continue to hunt them down one by one. A strike near Eshlambar, southwest of Tehran, killed at least 15 people, as authorities said. Five others were killed when a residential area in the city of Qom was hit, and six more were killed in strikes in other cities, the state-run Iran Daily newspaper reported. Three more people were killed when an airstrike hit a home in Tehran, Iranian state television reported. War's death toll in the thousands. More than 1,900 people have been killed in Iran since the war began, but its government has not updated the toll for days. In Lebanon, which Israel has invaded by ground, more than 1,400 people have been killed and more than 1 million people have been displaced. 11 Israeli soldiers have died there while targeting Iranian-backed Hezbollah militants. In Gulf Arab states in the occupied West Bank, more than 24 people have died, while 23 have been reported dead in Israel, and 13 U.S. service members have been killed. A mountain hideout and aircraft under fire. U.S. carries out daring rescue of service member in Iran. The United States pulled off a daring rescue of two aviators whose fighter jet was shot down by Iran, plucking the pilot from behind enemy lines before setting off a complicated extraction of the second service member who hid deep in the mountains as Tehran called for Iranians to help capture him. The CIA looked to throw off Iran's government before the crew member was found, launching a deception campaign to spread word inside the Islamic Republic that the U.S. had already located him. Even as President Donald Trump and other U.S. officials described an almost cinematic mission, rescuers faced major obstacles, including two Black Hawk helicopters coming under fire and problems with two transport planes that forced the U.S. military to blow them up. This is the first time in military memory that two U.S. pilots have been rescued separately deep in enemy territory, Trump wrote early Sunday on his Truth Social platform. We will never leave an American warfighter behind. U.S. officials stayed silent as the operation played out. In a pair of social media posts, Trump said the operation over the weekend required the U.S. to remain completely silent to avoid jeopardizing the effort, even as the president and top members of the administration continuously monitored the airman's location. The White House and the Pentagon refused to publicly discuss details about the downed fighter jet for well over 24 hours after the initial crash, particularly about the first crew member rescued from the F-15E Strike Eagle, an effort that Trump later said took 7 hours in broad daylight over Iran. The United States and Iran's government then were both facing to find the second crew member, a weapons systems officer whose location neither side knew. The CIA spread word in Iran that the U.S. had found him and were moving him by ground to get him out of the country, according to a senior Trump administration official who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss details not yet made public. The confusion allowed the CIA time to uncover the location of the service member, who is hiding in a mountain crevice, the official said. He had climbed 7,000 feet despite being injured, said Senator Dave McCormick, a Pennsylvania Republican who told Fox News Sunday that he was briefed by a senior administration official involved in the operation. The intelligence agency sent the aviator's coordinates to the Pentagon and the White House, where Trump ordered a rescue operation. Iran urged the public to look for the enemy pilot. Meanwhile, an anchor on a channel affiliated with Iranian state television had been urging residents in the mountainous region of southwest Iran, where the fighter jet went down, to hand over any enemy pilot to police and promised a reward for anyone who did. Trump said the American aviator was being hunted down by enemies who were getting closer and closer by the hour. The United States was monitoring his location continuously, he said. At the right moment, Trump said he directed the military to send dozens of heavily armed aircraft to rescue the crew member, who the president said is seriously wounded but will recover. Iranian state media reported that airstrikes in southwestern Iran on Saturday killed at least three people and wounded others in the same area where the missing American crew member was believed to be. U.S. rescuers face obstacles with aircraft during the operation. The American rescue mission ran into major challenges behind enemy lines. Iran's Joint Military Command claimed it struck two U.S. Black Hawk helicopters taking part in the operation. A person familiar with the situation said the two helicopters were able to navigate to safe airspace, although it's unclear if they landed or if crew members were injured. The person spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss the sensitive information. Then the U.S. military was forced to bring in an additional aircraft to complete the rescue of the second service member due to the technical malfunction, according to a regional intelligence official briefed on the mission. The U.S. blew up two transport planes it was forced to leave behind because of the mishap, said the official, who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss the covert mission. Iran's state television on Sunday aired a video showing that it claimed were parts of a U.S. aircraft shot down by Iranian forces, along with a photo of the thick black smoke rising. The broadcaster said Iran had shot down a transport plane and two helicopters that were part of the rescue operation. Iran's Joint Military Command said that the destroyed aircraft included two C-130 military transport aircraft and two Black Hawk helicopters in the province of Isfahan, where the rescue took place. The fact that we were able to pull off both of these operations without a single American killed or even wounded just proves once again that we have achieved our overwhelming air dominance and superiority over the Iranian skies, Trump said on social media. A second U.S. military jet was also downed. Trump, however, did not mention that a second military jet also went down on the same day as the F-15E. Iranian state media said Friday that the U.S. A-10 attack carrier crashed after being struck by Iran's defense forces. A U.S. official speaking on the condition of anonymity to discuss a sensitive military situation confirmed a second Air Force combat aircraft went down in the Middle East on Friday. An additional U.S. pilot was rescued, but details were not available given the security concerns, another person familiar with the situation said. Neither provided more information, including whether or not it was an A-10. Artemis II astronauts race to set a new distance record from Earth and behold the moon's far side. With the moon looming ever larger, the Artemis II astronauts race to set a new distance record Monday from Earth on a lunar flyaround promising magnificent views of the far side never seen before by eye. The six-hour flyby is the highlight of NASA's first return to the moon since the Apollo era, with the three Americans and one Canadian. A step toward landing the boot prints near the moon's south pole in just 2 years. A prize and bragging rights awaits Artemis II. Less than an hour before kicking off the fly around the intense lunar observations, the four astronauts were set to become the most distant humans in history, surpassing the distance record of 248,655 miles set by Apollo 13 in April of 1970. Mission Control expected Artemis II to surpass that record by more than 4,100 miles. Artemis II is using the same maneuver that the Apollo 13 did after its Houston, "We have a problem." Oxygen tank explosion wiped out any hope of a moon landing. Known as a free return lunar trajectory, this no stopping to land route takes advantage of Earth's and the moon's gravity, reducing the need for fuel. It's a celestial figure eight that will put the astronauts on course for home once they emerge from behind the moon's Monday evening. Commander Reid Wiseman, pilot Victor Glover, Christina Koch, and Canada's Jeremy Hansen were on track to pass as close as 4,070 miles to the moon as their Orion capsule whips past it, hangs a U-turn, and then heads back toward Earth. It will take them 4 days to get back with a splashdown in the Pacific, concluding their test flight on Friday. Wiseman and his crew spent years studying lunar geography to prepare for this big event, adding solar eclipses to the repertoire during the past few weeks. By launching last Wednesday, they ensured themselves a total solar eclipse from their vantage point behind the moon, courtesy of the cosmos. topping their scientific target list, Oriental Basin, a sprawling impact basin with three concentric rings, the outermost which stretched nearly 600 miles across. Other sightseeing goals, the Apollo 12 and 14 landing sites from 1969 and 71, respectively, as well as fringes of the South Polar region, the preferred locale for future touchdowns. Farther afield, Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Saturn, not to mention Earth, will be visible. Their moon mentor, NASA geologist Kelsey Young, expects thousands of pictures. People all over the world connect with the moon. This is something that every single person on the planet can understand and connect with, she said on the eve of the flyby, wearing eclipse earrings. Artemis II is NASA's first astronaut moonshot since Apollo 17 in 1972. It sets the stage for next year's Artemis III, which will see another Orion crew practice docking with lunar landers in orbit around Earth. The culminating moon landing by two astronauts near the moon's south pole will follow on Artemis IV in 2028. While Artemis II may be taking Apollo 13's path, it's most reminiscent of Apollo 8 and humanity's first lunar visitors who orbited the moon on Christmas Eve 1968 and read from the Book of Genesis. Glover said flying to the moon during Christianity's Holy Week brought home for him the beauty of creation. Earth is an oasis amid a whole bunch of nothing, this thing we call the universe, where the humanity exists as one, he observed over the weekend. This is an opportunity for us to remember where we are, who we are, and that we are the same thing and that we've got to get through this together, Glover said, clasping hands with his crewmates. It's time for Artemis II to break Apollo 13's distance record. What to know about the moon flyby? The Artemis II astronauts are already the champions of a fresh new era of lunar exploration. Now it's time to set a new distance record. Launched last week on humanity's first trip to the moon since 1972, the three Americans and one Canadian are chasing after Apollo 13's maximum range from Earth. That will make them our planet's farthest emissaries as they swing around the moon without stopping on Monday and then hightail it back home. Their roughly six-hour lunar flyby promises views of the moon's far side that were too dark or too difficult to see by the Apollo 24, by the 24 Apollo astronauts who preceded them. A total solar eclipse also awaits them as the moon blocks the sun, exposing snippets of shimmering corona. We'll get eyes on the moon, kind of map it out, and then continue to go back and forth, said Flight Director Judd Freeling. The goal is a moon base replete with landers, rovers, drones, and habitats. A look at Artemis II's up-close and personal brush with another world, our constant companion, the moon. Apollo 13 holds the distance record from Earth. Apollo 13's astronauts missed out on a moon landing when one of their oxygen tanks ruptured on the way there in 1970. With the three lives in jeopardy, Mission Control pivoted to a free return lunar trajectory to get them home as fast and efficiently as possible. This routing relies on the gravity of Earth and the moon and minimal fuel. It worked for Apollo 13, turning into NASA's greatest success failure. For the record flight, director Gene Kranz never uttered failure is not an option. The line is pure Hollywood, originating from the 1995 biopic starring Tom Hanks. How Artemis II will surpass Apollo 13. Commander Jim Lovell, Fred Hayes, and Jack Swigart reached a maximum of 248,655 miles from Earth before making their life-saving U-turn on Apollo 13. Artemis II's astronauts are following the same figure-eight path since they are neither orbiting the moon nor landing on it, but their distance from Earth should exceed Apollo 13's by more than 4,100 miles. Artemis II's Christina Koch said late last week that she and her crewmates don't live on superlatives, but it's an important milestone that people can understand and wrap their heads around, merging the past with the present and even the future when new records are set. Artemis II astronauts take shifts for prime lunar views. During the flyby, the astronauts will split into pairs and take turns capturing the lunar views out of their windows with cameras. At closest approach, they will come within 4,070 miles of the moon. Because they launch on April 1st, the rendezvous won't have as much of the far lunar side illuminated as other dates would have, but the crew still will be able to make out definite chunks of the far side that have never been seen by humans, said NASA geologist Kelsey Young, including a good portion of Oriental Basin. They'll call down their observations as they photograph the gray, pockmarked scenes. There's a suite of professional quality cameras on board, and each astronaut also has an iPhone for more informal, spur-of-the-minute picture-taking. Young's team made lunar geography flashcards for the astronauts to study before the flight. They practiced for many, many, many months on visualizations of the moon, she said over the weekend, and getting their eyes on the real thing, I'm really looking forward to them bringing the moon a little closer to home on Monday. A total solar eclipse is in store during the moon flyby. The upside of the April 1st launch is a total solar eclipse. The eclipse won't be visible from Earth, only from the Orion capsule, treating the astronauts to several minutes worth of views of the sun's outermost radiating atmosphere, the corona. The astronauts will be on the lookout for any unusual solar activity during the eclipse, Young said, and will use their unique vantage point to describe the features of the solar corona or crown. All four astronauts packed eclipse glasses to protect their eyes. How long the brief blackout before the moon lasts? Orion will be out of contact with mission control for nearly an hour when it's behind the moon. The same thing happened during the Apollo moonshots. NASA is relying on its deep space network to communicate with the crew, but the giant antennas in California, Spain, and Australia won't have a direct line of sight when Orion disappears behind the moon for approximately 40 minutes. These communication blackouts were always a tense time during Apollo, although, as Freeling points out, physics take over and physics will absolutely get us back to the front side of the moon. It's homeward bound for Artemis II after the moon flyby. Once Artemis II departs the lunar neighborhood, it will take 4 days to return home. The capsule will aim for a splashdown in the Pacific near San Diego on April 10th, 9 days after its Florida launch. During the flight back, the astronauts will link up via radio with the crew of the orbiting International Space Station. This is the first time that a moon crew has colleagues in space at the same time, and NASA can't pass up the opportunity for a cosmic chit-chat. The conversation will include both members of the first all-female spacewalk in 2019, Coke aboard Orion and Jessica Meir on the station. Meet the Artemis crew in NASA's first astronaut mission to the moon in more than half a century. The four astronauts making NASA's next lunar leap bear little resemblance to the Apollo era. The Americans who blazed the trail to the moon more than half a century ago were white men chosen for their military test pilot experience. The first Artemis crew includes a woman, a person of color, and a Canadian, products of a more diversified astronaut corps. None of them were alive during NASA's storied Apollo program that sent 24 astronauts to the moon, including 12 moonwalkers. They won't land on the moon this time or even orbit it, but the out-of-the-back journey will take them thousands of miles deeper into space than even the Apollo astronauts ventured, promising unprecedented views of the lunar far side. Here's a look at the Artemis astronauts, whose mission aims to pave the path for future moon landings. Commander Reed Wiseman, leading the nearly 10-day mission, is a widower who considers solo parenting, not rocketing to the moon, his biggest and most rewarding challenge. Wiseman, 50, a retired Navy captain from Baltimore, was serving as the NASA's chief astronaut when asked 3 years ago to lead humanity's first lunar trip since 1972. His wife Carol's death from cancer in 2020 gave him pause. He'd spent more than 5 months at the International Space Station in 2014, and his two teenage daughters, especially the older one, had zero interest in him launching again. We talked about it, and I said, look, all of these people on planet Earth right now, there are four people that are in a position to go fly around the moon, he said. I cannot say no to that opportunity. The next day, homemade moon cupcakes awaited him, along with his daughter's support. The toughest part isn't leaving them, it's the stress that I'm putting on them, he said. Open with daughters about everything, he recently told them, where he keeps his will. Pilot Victor Glover. As one of NASA's few black astronauts, Glover sees his presence on the mission as a force for good. The 49-year-old Navy captain and former combat pilot from Pomona, California, makes it a habit to listen to Gil Scott Heron's Whitey on the Moon and Marvin Gaye's Make Me Wanna Holler from the white-dominated Apollo era. I listen to those for perspective, he said. It captures what we did well and what we did poorly. The ability for him now to offer hope to others is an amazing blessing and a privilege. Despite having one space flight behind him, an early SpaceX crew run to the International Space Station, he finds himself in a new personal territory. His four daughters in their late teens and early 20s, and I spend as much time and thought preparing for them as NASA does preparing me. He's hyper-focused on running our best race so that we can hand the baton off to the next leg, a 2027 practice docking mission in orbit around Earth between an Orion crew capsule and one or two lunar landers. The all-important moon landing would follow in 2028 with yet another set of astronauts. Mission Specialist Christine Koch. The last time Koch blasted into space, she was gone almost a year, so she's not sweating a quick trip to the moon and back. The 47-year-old electrical engineer from Jacksonville, North Carolina, holds the record for the longest single spaceflight by a woman, 328 days. She took part in the first all-female spacewalk during her lengthy stay at the space station in 2019. More than any one individual, it's about celebrating the fact that we've arrived at this place in history where women can fly to the moon, she said. Before she got called up by NASA, Koch spent a year at the South Pole's research station. Between that and her space stint, she feels inoculated most of her family and friends. So far, I haven't gotten too many nerves from folks, maybe my dog, but I've reassured her that it's only 10 days. It's not going to be as long as last time. Her and her husband's rescue pooch is named Sadie Lou. Canadian Space Agency's Jeremy Hansen. The Canadian fighter pilot and physicist is making his space debut, stressful enough, but also serving as his country's first emissary to the moon. Maybe I'm naive, but I don't feel a lot of personal pressure. Hansen, 50, grew up on a farm near London, Ontario, before moving to Ingersoll and pursuing a flying career. The Canadian Space Agency selected him as an astronaut in 2009, and he was named to the Artemis crew in 2023. He realizes only now how much effort it took to send men to the moon during Apollo. When I walk out and look at the moon now, it looks and feels a little bit farther than it used to be. I just understand in the details how much harder it is than I thought it was watching videos of it. Danger still looms, something he shared with his colleague-aged son and twin daughters. The most likely outcome is that we will come back safe. There's a chance we won't, and we'll be able to move through life even if that happens, he assured them. Savannah Guthrie back at Today anchor desk for the first time since her mother's disappearance. Savannah Guthrie was back at NBC's Today Show anchor desk on Monday for the first time in more than 2 months since her mother's disappearance, saying it's good to be home. Here we go, ready or not, Guthrie said as the show opened. Let's do the news. Guthrie had acknowledged that she's a changed person, that it's hard to go forward not knowing what happened to Nancy Guthrie, who authorities believe was taken against her will from her Arizona home. Despite an intense search involving thousands of federal and local officers and volunteers, there's been no sign of the 84-year-old mother of three since she was reported first missing February 1st. As part of a video message released by her New York church on Easter Sunday, Guthrie spoke about feeling moments of deep disappointment with God, the feeling of utter abandonment. But she said that the resurrection is not fully celebrated if we do not acknowledge the feelings of loss, pain, and yes, death. In announcing her return to the NBC's flagship morning show, Guthrie said she was uncertain whether she'll feel like she still belongs. It's hard to imagine doing it because it's such a place of joy and lightness, she said just a week ago on Today during her first interview since the disappearance. I can't come back and try to be something that I'm not, but I can't come back because it's my family. Guthrie, one of the morning television's most recognizable faces, has been a co-anchor on Today since 2012. She doesn't anticipate faking her way through the show, which is normally lighthearted with a mix of serious breaking news. There's been a great deal of speculation about whether she would return. I want to smile, and when I do it, it will be real, she told Hoda Kotb, who came back to Today to fill in for Guthrie while focused on the search. Being there is joyful, and when it's not, I'll say so. Nancy Guthrie made occasional appearances on Today over the years, once taking part in a cooking demonstration and surprising her daughter on set. When Savannah Guthrie returned to her hometown of Tucson in 2025 for a segment recorded for the show, the two visited one of their favorite restaurants and talked about their love of Arizona. The Guthrie family has offered a $1 million reward for information leading to the recovery of their mother. Authorities believe Nancy Guthrie was kidnapped, abducted, or otherwise taken against her will after finding blood near the doorstep of her home in the foothills outside of Tucson. The FBI later released surveillance video showing a masked man on the porch that night. Volunteers and search teams scoured the nearby desert terrain filled with cactuses, bushes, and boulders in the first weeks after she vanished. But attention has faded from an investigation that was declared to be a top priority for the FBI and local authorities. Investigators have not released new evidence in weeks and say the number of tips has slowed. The FBI and the Pima County Sheriff's Department both said late last week they had no new updates. Early on, some media outlets reported receiving ransom messages tied to the case. Guthrie said she and her siblings responded to two that they believe were real and offered to pay. Guthrie said her celebrity status might be the reason her mother was taken, but that possibility was too much to bear. Menopause products are having a hot minute, but the doctors urge women to be wary of the marketing surge. Women suffering through hot flashes, night sweats, mood changes, and sleep problems that can come with menopause, all while looking in the mirror and noticing signs of aging, are being bombarded with products. More open conversations about menopause and the period leading up to it, called perimenopause, are happening at the same time that marketing has been supercharged by social media. Women are being confronted by lotions and serums and light masks that promise to rejuvenate their face and necks, dietary supplements claiming to do everything from boost moods to ease hot flashes, and gadgets promising to help with symptoms. The marketing has gotten very, very aggressive. It's pervasive, said Dr. Nanette Santoro, an OBGYN professor at the University of Colorado Anschutz. Santoro and other physicians say that before spending lots of money on products that make big promises, it's important for women to talk to their doctors about what has actually been proven to help and what could be harmful. It really pays to be very, very skeptical, Santoro said. A flood of marketing. A menstruation winds down, women's levels of estrogen and progesterone drop. In some women, the symptoms can include hot flashes, night sweats, mood changes, vaginal dryness, and sleep problems. Dr. Angela Angel, an OBGYN with Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital Dallas, said that in the past, doctors would ask women around the age of 50 during their early exam if they were noticing any symptoms. But now, she said, patients are making separate appointments and initiating the conversations. And at those appointments, she said, many patients tell her that they've already tried something. They're coming in to see me because it's not effective or because it's caused some other side effect, Angel said. Her hospital has recently started a menopause support group led by doctors, and at the request of participants, an upcoming session will focus on helping women navigate through the marketing onslaught. Products aimed at women in that stage of life include anything from bracelets and rings claiming to help ease hot flashes to cooling blankets and bedding. Santoro said her advice to patients is to balance what you're going to spend over whether this might help you. If a bracelet that's going to cost you $20, it's not a big expenditure. It might provide some improvement, Santoro said. Things that are not well tested might still work, but if you want something that works, come back and not go anywhere, and I'll give you evidence-based treatment. Santoro said dietary supplements have not been proven in multiple well-done studies to alleviate hot flashes, but many are low cost with a low potential for harm. She said if a patient wants to try something they see online, it's important or at least to tell their doctors so they can be monitored while taking it or warned off. Doctors note that most of the time over-the-counter products like dietary supplements, shampoos, or skincare that are advertised for menopausal women aren't different from regular products for that purpose ingredient-wise. And some products could have side effects. Advice from doctors. Dr. Monica Christmas, director of the menopause program at the University of Chicago Medicine, said that there's not one symptom everyone gets. Some women get few or none, she said, while others are extremely impacted by a variety of symptoms. What's most important, she said, is seeking medical help. Doctors say the hormone therapy prescribed by a doctor can help with symptoms, as can prescriptions for non-hormonal medication. Some women are advised to avoid hormone therapy because they have had certain medical issues. Not everyone needs hormone therapy. Not everyone is a candidate for hormone therapy. Not everyone should be on hormone therapy, Angel said. Regular exercise and a healthy diet can help a lot, doctors say. That can help with weight loss, which is associated with reducing hot flashes and night sweats. Ann Santoro notes that avoiding alcohol is a good step for someone with hot flashes since it can make them worse. Many of the symptoms actually get better over time, so sometimes it's really just a matter of lifestyle modifications and self-care and getting through this most tumultuous time frame, Christmas said. For Brandy Magruder, a 49-year-old school librarian from Dallas, it clicked that she was in perimenopause last year when she went out to dinner for her birthday. When she and her friends entered the steakhouse, she was freezing cold. About 20 minutes later, she was burning up. She said she made an appointment with her doctor who prescribed an estrogen patch, which helped. Magruder said she's seen the advertisement for products aimed at women her age, but her first stop was her doctor. Magruder said that while she doesn't like the way the symptoms have driven home that she's getting older, she's also embracing this time for her in her life. Her advice, laugh. It's okay. Reach out to others, experience what you're going through. Don't take it so serious. Concerns about skin. There are changes with skin that come both with time as one ages and during menopause as skin gets less thick because of a loss of collagen and some of the acid that supports skin, said Dr. Melissa Maskauer, a dermatologist and associate professor at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. Maskauer said using a prescribed retinoid or an over-the-counter retinol can help. Both assist with the production of collagen and reduce the appearance of wrinkles. She said good over-the-counter moisturizers can be found at drugstores. Her advice is to look for ones with ceramides, which help skin hydrate it. But you don't have to do anything that too many addictive ingredients. Just because it's natural and a botanical does not mean it's better, Mosker said. A lot of those actually are contact allergens that can make people more sensitive. Ingestible collagen is among the products being marketed to women, but she warns the studies are mixed and ingesting it doesn't mean it's going to make its way back to your skin and plump up your face, even though products claim it will. Light masks, she said, won't hurt and some studies show they could help, but they won't make a difference overnight. She said seeing any improvements from them would likely take daily use for many years. She said sun damage is one of the biggest reasons patients have more wrinkles, so consistent use of sunscreen is a must for all ages. I think there are a lot of new fancy things coming out and targeted to perimenopause, menopause patients, Mosker said. But sometimes the tried and true things that we at least have the science for, I think, still are my kind of gold standards for my patients. Tailors and dressmakers retire their pincushions as U.S. demand for skilled sewers grows. Hunched over a sewing machine, Kilby is hemming a dress inside his Manhattan tailor shop when a new customer stops by with a vintage Tommy Hilfiger jacket he wants taken in. The modeling agent paid $20 at a thrift store for his reversible bomber style that's plaid on one side and red on the other. He's willing to spend $280 to have it slimmed down. Alteration requests with such a price disparity would have seemed odd a few years ago, the tailor says, but are helping to keep the bobbins bobbing at this one-man shop, 85 Custom Tailor. Bai carefully examines the cotton jacket before moving to pin it, circling the customer like a sculptor with a chisel. He started training as a tailor at the age of 17 in his native South Korea. Now 63, he's part of a shrinking breed in the U.S., where professional sewers, dressmakers, and tailors are aging out of the workforce as their services find fresh demand. Shoppers who grew up on disposable fast fashion are enlisting tailors and seamstresses to give off-the-rack purchases a custom fit or personal flair to revive secondhand finds or to extend the lives of their wardrobes, according to fashion industry experts. Weight loss drugs like Zepbound and Wegovy mean more Americans are seeking adjusted waistbands, tapered sleeves, and other types of resizing, Bai said. I recommend this job to young people because this one cannot be AI'd, Bai said, noting artificial intelligence is an automating pattern making but so far can't replicate a tailor's handiwork. Different bodies, different shape. They cannot copy like this. If I close this door, I can go out and find another one. But like engraving, repairing musical instruments, and many other skilled trades, creating and fitting garments to individual specifications hasn't attracted enough entry-level workers over the years to replace the professionals retiring their pincushions after decades of performing their craft. An aging occupation. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics estimated almost 2 years ago that there were fewer than 17,000 tailors, custom sewers, and dressmakers working in business establishments nationwide, a 30% decline from a decade earlier. Including self-employed individuals and people working in private households, the median age for all sewers, dressmakers, and tailors was 54 last year, 12 years older than the median for the entire employed population, according to the Bureau. The income that a proficiency with needle and thread command relative to the skills needed and the physical toll of bending over detailed work for hours likely discourages teenagers and young adults from heeding Bay's advice, fashion industry experts said. The mean annual wage tailors, dressmakers, and customer sewers earned as of May 2024 was $44,050 a year, compared to $68,000 for all workers according to the BLS calculations. Most of the fashion training is really aimed at mass production, not spending time in hand shops hand-making a garment, said Scott Carnes, the provost of LIM College, a for-profit college that offers degrees and disciplines from the business side of fashion. The work is also tedious. Online job postings for tailors, dressmakers, and sewers have remained fairly stable, according to Corey Stahl, an economist with the research arm of job site Indeed. Between February 2020 and at the end of the same month last year, advertised openings decreased by roughly 2%, while postings for both marketing and software jobs declined by nearly 30%. There is a kind of craftsmanship that I think is an important piece that we can't ignore, Stahl said, who focuses on the U.S. labor market, said. America's skilled sewers. Immigrants without permanent legal status, refugees and naturalized citizens have powered America's garment industry for well over a century. An analysis of a recent census data by the Migration Policy Institute found about 40% of tailors, dressmakers, and sewers were foreign-born, according to Julia Gallette, associate director of the nonpartisan think tank U.S. Immigration Policy Program. The biggest shares come from Mexico, South Korea, Vietnam, and China, she said. To address a worsening labor shortage, the fashion industry is looking to create a new generation of master tailors. Nordstrom, North America's largest employer of tailors and alteration specialists, teamed up with New York's Fashion Institute of Technology to launch a 9-week program in advance of sewing and alteration techniques. Customarily, tailoring has never been part of the American skill set, said an instructor in Broadway costume builder Michael Harrell, who teaches the course. Retailers see a growing market. The Fashion Institute received 200 applications for the inaugural cohort of 15 students who started in October and received certificates of completion in February, said Jacqueline Jenkins, the executive director of the school's Center for Continuing and Professional Studies. The hands-on training was designed to prepare participants to work at Nordstrom. The luxury department store chain employs 1,500 people to provide tailoring and alterations, from hemming jeans and repairing rips to fitting suits and reworking evening gowns. 10 members of the first class were hired are in the process of being hired, Marco Equizio, Nordstrom's director of alterations, said. We owe it to the broader industry to ensure that this is an art that exists for years and years to come and continues to serve customers both within our walls as well as outside, he said. Meanwhile, other retailers are expanding their tailoring services because of demand. Brooks Brothers, a luxury brand that has made custom men's clothing since the 1800s, tested a similar service for women at 5 stores last year. This year, it expanded bespoke women's tailoring to 40 more stores. Prices start at $165 for shirts and $1,398 for suits, the company said. No one to take over. Back at 85 Custom Tailor, Bay asked more than once if the customer with the Tommy Hilfiger jacket was certain he wanted to proceed with the alterations. Jonathan Reese, 33, was sure. He said he planned to wear the jacket often. I think I fell victim to buying cheap stuff, and then you realize it just falls apart or shrinks or just doesn't last long, Reese said. Bay has a son who's a year older than Reese, he tried to persuade him to go into tailoring. The son used to work with computers and then opened a bagel shop. Young people, they just want to find a job in computers, Bay said. I think that's too boring. I think this is very interesting. Every time I am drawing in my head, I am like an artist. Bay trained under his older sister and brother at their customs apparel shop at about 93 miles from Seoul. After 5 years, he moved to South Korea's capital to work on custom orders and samples for various companies. He moved to the New York City area where he worked as a patent maker for Ralph Lauren, Donna Karan, and other designer brands. He opened his own shop in Connecticut in 2011, but the COVID-19 pandemic forced him to close after a decade. He reopened in his current location a year later. He uses different sewing machines, a basic one, another one for heavy materials like denim and leather, and an overlock machine which cuts, trims, and finishes fabric edges simultaneously. Bay said he intends to keep working as long as his hands stay steady enough. I'm always learning, he said. Trump administration agencies post Easter message celebrating Christ's resurrection. Numerous previous presidents have issued statements in recognition of Easter Sunday. This year, the Trump administration went a step farther with several key cabinet departments heralding Christ's resurrection on their official social media accounts. He is risen, declared the Department of Homeland Security and the State Department. The Defense Department shared a post on X from the Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. The tomb is empty. The promise is fulfilled. Through his sacrifice, we are redeemed. We stand firm in faith, courage, and truth. The Justice Department also chimed in on X. Today, as millions of Christians gather in their churches across the nation to celebrate the resurrection of Christ, this department is proud to protect and defend religious liberty, it said. The post drew thousands of comments. Some people expressed joy at the department's open embrace of Christianity. Others were outraged, saying government agencies should not be promoting the doctrine of a particular faith. Hegseth frequently invokes his evangelical faith as head of the armed forces, depicting a Christian nation trying to vanquish its foes with military might. Last week, Hegseth hosted his first monthly Christian workshop service at the Pentagon since the Iran war began. Let every round find its mark against the enemies of righteousness and our great nation, Hegseth prayed during the live stream service. Give them wisdom in every decision, endurance for the trial ahead, unbreakable unity and overwhelming violence of action against those who deserve no mercy. Trump, in a statement issued on Good Friday, evoked the Iran war only indirectly. From the Christian patriots who won and secured our liberty on the battlefield in every generation since, the love of Christ has unfailingly guided our nation through calm waters and dark storms, he said. On Easter Sunday morning, his tone was harsher. In a profanity-laced post on Truth Social, he demanded that Iran open the Strait of Hormuz by Tuesday, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah. The Council on American-Islamic Relations, a nationwide advocacy group, responded by assailing Trump's deranged mocking of Islam. Statements of faith are common in American public life, across political parties and religious traditions. Pentagon aides and Hegseth's defenders cite examples from history, such as Franklin D. Roosevelt's support for issuing Bibles to troops. But the overall tradition, widely adhered to over the decades, has been for presidents and their administrations to honor the constitutional separation of church and state, and to avoid a clear-cut favoring of one faith over others. Past presidents have had various tones in their Easter messages. Republican George W. Bush in 2003 explicitly celebrated the resurrection of Christ. Republican Ronald Reagan and Democrat Barack Obama sometimes issue messages recognizing both Easter and Passover. A gray whale that swam 20 miles up a Washington state river is found dead. A juvenile gray whale that amazed Washington state residents after it swam 20 miles up a small river was found dead. And an official with a marine mammal research group suspects hunger may have driven the whale to a new hunting grounds as the species population declines. The whale was discovered Saturday near Raymond, Washington in the Willapa River, which feeds into the ocean at Willapa Bay. A number of gray whales are currently in the bay on their 5,000-mile spring migration from birthing grounds in Baja California, Mexico, north to feeding grounds in Alaska. The larger issue that the population of gray whales is the eastern part of the Pacific Ocean has faced since 2019 is reduced food availability in the northern Bering and Chukchi seas off Alaska's coast. John Kalambakados, a research biologist with the Cascadia Research Collective, told the Associated Press on Sunday. Gray whales are facing a major crisis, and the heart of it does seem to be feeding on their prey in the Arctic, he said. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Fisheries Agency declared an unusual mortality event for eastern gray whales, meaning those in the Pacific from late 2018 to 2023. It involved 690 gray whale strandings during that time, stretching from Alaska to Mexico. NOAA fisheries investigators concluded that preliminary cause was localized ecosystem changes in the whales, subarctic and arctic feedings areas that led to changes in food, malnutrition, decreased birth rates, and increased mortality. Officials believe the population was rebounding, but the most recent count from 2025 instead showed a continuing decline. The federal agency estimated there are about 13,000 gray whales, the lowest count since the 1970s. A lot of these gray whales are looking very emancipated, very thin, he said. Their migration north is typically the most challenging period for gray whales, the longest they've gone without eating, forcing the animals to use up their nutritional reserves. When that happens, you often see gray whales in more desperate search for new areas to feed, he said. That's the most likely context for this whale. Researchers will attempt to examine the whale possibly as soon as Monday. It entered the North Fork of the Wallapa River on Wednesday via a bay about 185 miles southwest of Seattle. Residents gathered on bridges along the river just to catch a glimpse of the massive mammal and flooded social media with photos of video expelling air through its blowhole. While the gray whale appeared thin, it was behaving normally and didn't appear to have any injuries, the nonprofit Cascadia Research Collective said in a Facebook post. The organization was giving the whale time and space to leave the river on its own, but when researchers attempted to find it Friday, the animal had traveled further upriver into waters that were unnavigable by boat, Kalambakados said. Pressure mounts on Yee to be pulled from his headline role at a summer festival in London. Pressure was mounting Sunday on American rapper Yee to be pulled from his headline role at a London music festival this summer after criticism from UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer. Pepsi already has withdrawn its lead sponsorship role of the wireless festival at Finsbury Park in North London between July 10th and the 12th. Other sponsors of the event, including Budweiser and PayPal, are being urged to follow suit. Pepsi didn't provide an explicit reason for its decision to pull out of the event, even though publicity for the festival promoted the event was under the branding Pepsi Presents Wireless. Pepsi has decided to withdraw its sponsorship of the Wireless Festival, the company said in a statement Sunday. Yee was booked to perform in front of around 150,000 revelers over the course of the festival's three nights. Yee, formerly known as Kanye West, changed his name in 2021, and he has drawn widespread controversy in recent years for a series of anti-Semitic remarks and has voiced admiration for Adolf Hitler. Last year, he released a song called "Heil Hitler," a few months after advertising a swastika T-shirt for sale on his website. The 48-year-old musician apologized for January for his anti-Semitic remarks in a letter published as a full-page advert in the Wall Street Journal. He said his bipolar disorder led him to fall into a four-month-long manic episode of psychotic, paranoid, and impulsive behavior that destroyed my life. Fans of his sold-out concert Friday at SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles, his first major U.S. performance in nearly 5 years, appeared to separate his personal beliefs and public statements from his music and were ready to forgive after his January apology letter. However, Starmer said it was deeply concerning that the rapper was booked to perform at the long-established festival. Anti-Semitism is, in any form, is abhorrent and must be confronted clearly and firmly wherever it appears, he said in remarks published by the Sun on Sunday newspaper. Everyone has a responsibility to ensure Britain is a place where Jewish people feel safe and secure. Yi's scheduled appearance follows signs of growing anti-Semitism in the UK. Two men and a 17-year-old boy were ordered to remain in custody on Saturday on charges of torching four ambulances run by Jewish Community Service in northwest London. And last October, two men died in an attack on a Manchester synagogue. Phil Rosenberg, president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, said it was absolutely the wrong decision to allow Yi to play. Wireless Festival didn't immediately comment when contacted. UCLA storms past South Carolina to claim its first NCAA women's basketball title. Its mission accomplished for UCLA. Gabrielle Jacquez, Lauren Betts, and the rest of the UCLA seniors secured their first NCAA women's basketball national championship in school history, a goal that was set after losing in the first Final Four last season. Jacquez scored 21 points, Betts added 16, and UCLA routed South Carolina 79-51 Sunday in the title game. The near-record lopsided victory completed the Bruins' journey through this year's March Madness. The Bruins ran through their opponents this season, with their only loss coming in November to Texas in a Thanksgiving tournament. J.J. Spahn rallies to win Texas Open for first title since U.S. Open. J.J. Spahn came up with two big shots at the end of a long, wet Sunday, one leading to a birdie and the other for an eagle, that carried him to a 5-under-67 and a one-shot victory at the Valero Texas Open for his first title since the U.S. Open last summer. Weekend box office, Super Mario Galaxy jumps to a $190 million five-day debut. Rounding out the weekend box office to the weekend of April 3rd, in number 2, Project Hail Mary, number 3, The Drama, number 4, Hoppers, number 5, Reminders of Him, number 6, A Great Awakening, number 7, They Will Kill You, number 8, Durandahar, The Revenge, number 9, Ready or Not 2, Here I Come, and rounding out the top 10, Scream 7. This has been Cody Boynes on Monday, April 6th, reading for the Talking Information Center for the Associated Press News, and that is my time.